Thanks for joining us on The Exchange with Ed Stetzer, where we discuss truth, thoughts, and theology. On today's show, Ed spoke with one of Nashville's most influential singer-songwriters, Cindy Morgan. She's a two-time Grammy nominee. She's got 13 Dove Awards. She has 21 number one hits. She pens songs for well-known artists such as Amy Grant, Rascal Flatts, Natalie Grant, Michael W. Smith, and Francesca Battistelli. She co-created the Hymns for Hunger initiative to raise awareness and resources for hunger relief organizations, and she recently released a memoir entitled How Could I Ask for More? Stories of Blessings, Battles, and Beauty. Before we hear from Ed and Cindy, let's learn from author Gloria Furman about the gospel and motherhood.
How does the gospel transform motherhood? You may have been raised in a community or a family where motherhood was held in high esteem. It was a privilege and a gift. Or you may have been raised in a community or a family where motherhood kind of got in the way of your true potential. Or it was an inconvenience or something that was to be avoided at all costs. Motherhood is viewed differently all over the world. Where I live, for example, in the Middle East, motherhood, for some cultures, is a matter of sheer numbers and increasing a family's power. I was on the playground the other day with my four kids, and my neighbor came up and she said, "I see your baby is weaned. He's eating a biscuit. This is very good." And I said, "Yes, oh, thank God he's weaned." And she said, "Well, now it's time for you to have more babies to make your husband's house bigger." And I just kind of giggled because my hands are really full. And I told my husband later that night what she said, and he said, "Well, if that happens, we do need to make a bigger house." So motherhood, no matter where it is that you're living, all of us need to have our minds transformed by the Word of God, and the gospel transforms motherhood when we see what God's Word says about it. So whatever ideas you have about motherhood, the gospel sets us all straight. Motherhood is not about adding to your value as a woman. Motherhood is not about diminishing your value as a woman. Motherhood is actually about a different person altogether. Motherhood is about Jesus Christ. So specifically, motherhood is about a man, the God-man, Jesus Christ. And in the Bible, we see that motherhood was God's idea to glorify himself through his son. So motherhood isn't about us at all. And it makes sense, because when we make motherhood about us, we get judgmental, hypercritical, bored, and anxious. Doesn't that make sense? If motherhood is about us, then it ends on us. But if motherhood is not about us, if it's about Jesus Christ, then everything about our motherhood is worship. So, what does the Bible say about this? We see that motherhood was God's idea. So in Genesis, back when he made Adam and Eve, man and woman, and he told them to multiply, fill, and subdue the earth, this is a job that they cannot do by themselves. They need each other, and they can't do any of this without the help of God either. So codependent on one another, utterly dependent on God, multiply, fill, and subdue the earth. But then what happened? They had this idea that they don't need God. They can reject his rule and live by their own law. And so they listened to the hissing lies of a serpent and then took the forbidden fruit and fell into sin. So now all of us are born into this sin. We are growing up with the understanding that death is a part of life. And that is not the way that God designed it. Death is not supposed to be a part of life. But how is it that we're here now? So we hear God's heartbeat of mercy. Even when he pronounced the curse on the serpent, he said that the seed of the woman would crush the serpent's head. The offspring of the woman. Did you hear that? There will be offspring. So in light of death, the just judgment that we deserve because of our sin, there would be life anyway. So God, in his mercy, has made it so that we will have life through procreation. We keep going. The human race keeps going in spite of our sin. And this is total, utter mercy from God. Our motherhood is an act of worship because we're utterly dependent on God who gives life in spite of death. So now, instead of making motherhood all about ourselves and living apart from God and his laws, we now have an opportunity through the gospel to see how our motherhood propels us to worship God. We see who we are. We see who our children are, And now we can worship him rightly through looking at his word.
Cindy, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
Good. Let's talk a little bit about your new album, Bows and Arrows. Mm-hmm. Why Bows and Arrows?
Well, there's a song on the record called Bows and Arrows, and it's a song. I think the reason I wanted to call the record Bows and Arrows is because it was the first song that I wrote, kind of back up a little bit for the last 8 years. I've really been more focused on being a full-time songwriter, yeah, and have not been doing my own singer-songwriter
records. And you've written for a lot of people.
Well-known.
You're one of the most influential songwriters, singer-songwriters in Nashville. So.
Well, I don't know about that, but I've been really grateful to be able to write for other people and to still be involved in the music community, but to really be home more with my kids, yeah, because that was really the tough thing for me, the decision that I made, you know, back when I started having my two daughters. It was hard to face a life on the road, yep, when I had babies at
home.
And so for me, I pushed pause on being an artist and just became a full-time songwriter. Mm-hmm. And so now that my kids are a little older, I felt like it was time that I could, you know, maybe go out
step
and do some touring.
Yeah.
And so Bows and Arrows was a song I wrote about our oldest daughter, Olivia. And, yeah, of course, our youngest daughter, Savannah, is also in there as well. But it really was inspired by the summer that we were in Canada. My husband is Canadian, so we live in Canada in the summer. And we were going for a walk in this meadow, and I saw Olivia walking up ahead of us. And she had this yellow dress on, and it was the summer she had her growth spurt.
Yeah.
And she started just asking all sorts of questions about, you know, boys and even, you know, God and the,
yeah,
meaning of life.
Sure.
And I just saw her leaving that moment of childhood and becoming her own,
yeah,
woman, you know, that first step. And it's just like the most terrible and beautiful thing. And so it made me want to write a song about it, and so, yeah, so the song is about that,
yeah,
and so she is actually on the cover. It's, yeah, her. She's in archery, and so it's a picture of her with this bow and arrow.
That's
pulled
so
back,
great.
And it's pretty beautiful. But anyway,
that's great.
Yeah,
I am the father of all daughters.
Oh,
as
you
well.
Are.
I have three,
okay,
daughters, and so I totally understand. And by the way, my oldest daughter loves your stuff,
yeah,
and so, and a big fan. People don't understand, what is a songwriter?
Uh-huh.
I mean, what is that? You said you work as a songwriter. Mm-hmm. People think that people are sitting around a campfire, maybe late one night, and they just put together,
yeah,
a song. But there's if you live in Nashville, people know this, mm-hmm, more, but there's a work to this. I mean, you go,
yes,
to a place and you work,
yes,
with people. Tell people how does ideation of songwriting look like?
Ooh, ideation.
Oh, sorry.
That
it's
is
a,
an excellent
sorry.
Word. The process, you know, for writing, and it's different for everyone,
yeah,
but I think traditionally here in Nashville, which, you know, Nashville is really the home of the songwriter.
Yeah.
I mean, they're,
yeah,
they're really some of the great poets of songwriting live here in Nashville. And so for a lot of people, it is, we start at 10.
Yeah.
That's like,
that's
the universal,
yeah,
start time for songwriting. But, you know, you meet at someone's studio or someone's house or someone's, there's a lot of writers' rooms all, mm-hmm, around Nashville. You go and it's usually like a small room, mm-hmm, with hopefully a window and a piano in the corner and a couple guitars and some comfy seats,
mm-hmm,
and you meet and you have a good conversation, and usually someone has an idea for,
yeah,
a song, or maybe sometimes you don't,
right,
and you just, the song comes from the conversation that you have. And, you know, it's a strange,
yeah,
process, especially, you know, for me, I write a lot with artists.
Right.
And
the performers who actually sing the song, you actually write with them,
yeah,
to develop it.
Sometimes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's always the best, because, you know, otherwise you're getting in a room, and country music is a lot like this, in that in country music, writers get together and they write a song and they pitch it, and it's kind of a shot in the dark,
right,
but, you know, if it's a great song, like my friend Tom Douglas, who wrote The House That Built Me,
yeah,
you know, that's a song that he and Alan Shamblin wrote like I don't know, 9 years ago and couched it because it wasn't quite right yet.
Yeah.
And they brought it back out years later and kept working on it. But that was a song they wrote for them that Miranda Lambert really connected with. And so, you know, it's a process that can happen a lot of ways.
Okay, so I mean, I know like on your most recent album, you wrote most or co-wrote a couple, but wrote or co-wrote all the songs on your on your current album, but you've also written for others. I mean, what were some songs that we might know that you co-wrote or were part of writing?
All right, I'll reach way back and then I'll bring you up current. So back when I first started really being focused on being a writer, I wrote a lot of Rachel Lampe's first record, So Blessed, if you remember that song. Michael W. Smith and I have written several songs together. One song of his that comes to mind is I Will Be Your Friend. He and I wrote Make Us One together. My very first cut as a writer was on Sandy Patty's record.
No way.
Which was a song called When I Heal.
Yeah.
A little more current. And I Mandisa.
Yeah.
I've had a few songs.
Former Lifeway employee Mandisa.
Oh, that's
by the way.
Right. Yeah. So a few Mandisa songs. What If We Were Real? There's several on.
Lots on my iPhone right now.
Yeah. Okay. So. All right. And then more recent, Hurricane, which was Natalie Grant's single that was nominated for a Grammy a couple of years back, and then most recent that you probably would know was Laura Story, Oh Love of God.
Yeah.
Won a Dove Award this year.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Inspirational Song of the Year.
Crazy. So why do you think that, you made fun of my ideation word, why do you think Christians should be involved in the arts? And you're writing, you both write in the Christian genre, but you also write outside the Christian genre. As an artist, why do you think it's important that Christians be in that space, writing and singing inside and outside of kind of the Christian bubble?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. I mean, I immediately think about what C.S. Lewis said, in that there's no Christian way to boil an egg, and I believe there's no way to separate. If you're a person of faith, then you cannot separate your faith from your vocation, whatever that is. And so for me, I am first a believer, but I also have an interest in writing songs that are impactful in people's lives. And that includes people who are not Christians.
Sure.
You know, and so I guess I believe that we are called to excellence in whatever we do. And I mean, I think that songwriting, if a song is meaningful, it should impact people more than just people who have already come to the party.
Yeah.
You know, people who are already in the choir. And so So I think that we definitely need to be having an impact in the world.
Yeah.
To putting good, excellent product into the world.
Interesting. Okay, so I was talking on the show earlier, we had Lecrae on, and he said something like, Christian is my faith, not my genre.
Yeah,
and so,
that's good.
So you have, though, you're kind of in the different, you're in more than one space. So, and I think most Christians would say, well, I understand Christian music, or even we'll talk a little bit about Hymns for Hunger, but they understand that. But help us know a little more. Why would we care about the good of society, the beauty of society, by writing and making music that is good, but not in the genre of Christian?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I mean, I think that's what we're called to. We are called to heal the brokenhearted. Yeah. We are called to loose the chains of those who are captive. And I think the arts have always been a big part of that. I mean, even if you go back to the great composers, you know, Bach and Beethoven and Mozart, they were all paid by the church to write those pieces. And I don't know, I believe that we are called to something in our life. And if you are called to the arts, then you are called to maximize your potential in that way. And I don't know whenever we started drawing lines between genres, I don't know.
Sacred and secular and all that.
I'm not sure it was a good idea.
Yeah, agree.
You know, I mean, we're just called to excellence.
I've been in my church for years. At the beginning, I had a great experience.
Every week I felt challenged by my pastor. I felt encouraged by small group.
I felt motivated by the message, no complaints. But after a while, things changed.
I felt like I was coasting. Church felt just so routine. I wasn't getting much out of church anymore.
Was it someone else's fault? My pastor? My small group?
Was it me? I was stuck in a rut. God showed me my attitude was all wrong.
And slowly started to change me. I had quit serving. Church had become all about me and my needs, rather than God and His glory.
I began to sit back and let everyone else serve.
But by His grace...
By His grace...
By His grace, the Lord changed my attitude from...
I want to I will.
I will.
I will.
Welcome back to The Exchange with Ed Stetzer. Our featured guest today is one of Nashville's most influential singer-songwriters, Cindy Morgan. We have the second part of their conversation after Tim Keller talks to us about what he thinks is the hardest part of discipleship.
One of the problems with discipleship, you can't hide. If you're trying to disciple people, you can't hide who you are. You can't hide behind lots of books and materials. You've got to be a godly person. You've got to be a patient person. You've got to be a wise person. You've got to be someone who, the more people get to know you, the more impressed they are with your balance, with your, that you are, for example, you see, most people have very strong temperaments. So some people are introverts, some people are extroverts. Some people tend to be very sweet and kind and tender, but not very bold. Other people tend to be dynamic and powerful, but not very sensitive. Everybody's got their temperament, and yet every temperament, that is every set of gifts, some people are prophetic, some people are priestly, some people are great leaders. Natural temperament always has a dark side. Always has a dark side, because the natural temperament of a person participates in your idols, your idolatries. So if you are a pretty kind, peacemaking type person, pretty tender, pretty sweet natured, it could be that's a temperament, but it also will probably participate in an approval idol. That is, you'll need very, one of the reasons you are that way is because you're good, because God has put that goodness in you. It's part of your temperament. It's part of God's sort of natural temperament, is part of God's common grace. But at the same time, you're probably too concerned about what people think about you. And as a result, you at points in which you may need to make a hard call, you won't do it. On the other hand, a person who tends to be bold and dynamic and everybody says, wow, what a leader, might participate in a power idolatry. So every part of your temperament has a dark side. And when you start to invite people into your life because you're discipling them, they're going to see those dark sides, and you're going to lose credibility unless by the supernatural growth of spiritual fruit. If you're a naturally bold person, you have actually developed the fruit of love and humility and gentleness. If you're a naturally a naturally sweet person, you develop the fruit of faithfulness. In other words, unless you really are a godly person, discipleship doesn't work. Because people are not going to really, really listen to what you're telling them if you bring them in and they see that you're really no better than anybody else. You're really no different than anybody else. You've got your insecurities. You know, you feel inferior about this. You've got prejudices. You got your big blind spots. Unless people see you being godly, they're not going to actually become disciples. You could turn them into lackeys, I suppose, especially if you have a dominant personality and they are needy enough. But I don't think you're going to produce disciples. And that's one of the big problems, is you can't take people where you aren't yourself. And an awful lot of us are not actually very godly. We get passionate, we get committed, you know, we get trained. But we haven't really grown in grace ourselves that much. And we have gaping holes in our holiness. And the people who know us best, like our spouses, know about it. But when you invite people in to disciple them, they'll start to see it too, and it can be pretty ineffective. Sorry to be so That's a kind of a stark thing to say, but after many years of watching my own successes and failures in discipleship and other people's successes and failures, I think that's one of the reasons I can give for why so often we fail to create Christ-like people.
Well, Cindy, I know you have a new book published by Worthy Publishing. How Can I Ask for More? Mm-hmm. Tell us about the title and tell us about the book.
Well, the title, How Can I Ask for More, is based on the title of a song I wrote on my very first record back in the 90s. And so that was really my first singer-songwriter record.
Nice.
Because my first record was really a lot of like really pop.
Yeah.
Up-tempo kind of music, and so that was the only piano ballad on the record that I wrote. And so anyway, but it's been the song that I think people have requested of me throughout the years, mm-hmm. more than anything else. And so they wanted me to write a book based on that song.
Yeah.
And the book took many, it kept evolving and changing, and I think I did 3 rewrites.
Really?
From start to finish.
Wow.
Over again.
Wow.
It was really bad,
yeah.
the first time.
Oh, gosh.
And I was like, oh, that's bad. And then the second one was not as bad. But anyway,
which is
I
a
was
goal,
just,
not as bad as a good
you
goal.
You know what
have.
I mean?
Yeah.
But I was just trying to really find my way to what the book was supposed
yeah.
to be. And really what I landed on was it's a book of stories.
Okay.
And some people would say it's kind of a memoir, but I don't think it's technically a memoir because it's just snippets of life, and it's not just my life, but the lives of other people that I came in contact mm-hmm. with and just the things that I learned from those
yeah.
experiences.
A lot of focus on blessings and things that have been encouraging and things of that sort?
Well, the subtitle is Blessings, Battles, and Beauty.
Yeah.
And so, and they're all 3 topics.
All within
that
the book,
are
yeah.
that are covered. And I think there's probably, there's a lot of battles in
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
There's more battles, I think, than stories of blessings, but the blessings are, I think, peppered inside the battles.
Yeah.
And so I think I was trying to just write stories. For instance, there's a story about my dad. Yeah. When I was the youngest of 6 kids, and so I was the last one to leave the nest, and I took a trip back home to visit him, and my mom was visiting her mother in Ohio. And it was basically the first time I had ever come in contact with depression that my dad was like, I mean, I think he was going through what I would know now as an empty nest depression.
Right, sure.
But just the experience of seeing the man that I had always seen so strong.
Yeah.
And then suddenly this really vulnerable
yeah.
moment for him in life. And you know, I'm from East Tennessee, so there's a lot of like colorful stories
sure.
about the people from East
there's
Tennessee.
There's a lot of great stories you can tell about East Tennessee as well.
Well, my mother was a Pentecostal preacher
wow.
in the hills of Kentucky,
nice.
Virginia, and Tennessee
wow.
in the early 70s, and just kind of her very, you know, it was kind of crazy in that she did something that was super unpopular, and but she felt. She felt very driven to do it. And so, you know, I had to tell her story a little bit about, you know, her background. And
yeah.
she actually died as a child and came back to life.
Wow.
Anyway, it's a lot of different stories from my life, some of my own battles
yeah.
with fear.
Well, you said that mm-hmm. it was more battles than blessings, but
mm-hmm.
then the battles often have the blessings. Why? As you write,
mm-hmm.
Why bring in some of the struggles into the world? You know, people just give me an upbeat book, but
yeah.
it's more than that. Why are the struggles there?
Well, you know, if we just look at it from classic good storytelling, a good story begins with a problem,
yeah.
and then it gets worse,
yeah.
and then it gets better.
Yeah.
And that's really what engages us. And I think... And I think for me, as a writer, I always think it's important to be vulnerable and to put your weaknesses and your brokenness out there so that other people don't feel that they are the only ones
sure.
who are broken
yeah.
and who have gone through brokenness and
yeah.
battles. And so, but you also have to have hope.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted every chapter, every story to reflect the hope that we have mm. in having hope in Christ,
yeah.
you know, and that underneath all of the the struggles in life that we experience, that there is always hope in Christ.
That's good. That's good. And you, of course, you're a songwriter, you're a performer, you're a book writer, you're sort of taking over all media. But in the midst of all that, you've also turned towards the hurting and the hungry in Hymns for the Hungry. Tell us a little about that project.
Hymns for Hunger. So this is a...
Hymns for Hunger.
You got it. No, it's... Hymns for Hunger is a project, is a tour. It's a charitable tour that Andrew Greer, who's a good friend of mine and another artist and co-writer of mine, he and I both had hymn records. So several years ago, we both did hymn records in a climate of... worship records,
yeah.
And so we were the oddballs, and we wanted to do a little tour of small churches that kind of don't get much attention on the tour circuit, and so but we wanted to attach a cause with it, and so we were talking about names, you know, what can we do, and then Andrew actually came up with the alliteration Hymns for Hunger, which I thought was just brilliant. And so Hymns for Hunger is a charitable tour, not nonprofit, but charitable. We partner with local organizations, whether that be a food pantry or a mission or a church that has a pantry in their doors. We do a free concert where the only cost of admission is at least one non-perishable food item or whatever we're raising, if it's coats or whatever. And so, and then we do a concert. We
in a small church
people,
venue.
We do everything.
You can do elsewhere.
We've done
missions.
We've done mega churches.
Wow.
We've done small churches, tiny churches.
Really.
We've done it all, you know. And we try and just work it out, you know, in the process of booking the tour, that we can do as much as we can. And then, you know, it's been wonderful. At the end of the show, there's like this huge truckload of food that's going to the pantry, and have a volunteer from that organization come up and speak to the audience about what the need is locally. What we have found is two things: that the need is greater than anyone realizes, and B, that nobody realizes that most people don't even realize there is a local food pantry, and they really have no idea, you know, what the need is. And so, and then a lot of times people begin to bring food and goods to that pantry on a regular basis, volunteer, and so it's been really great. We've had a good time, and we do our hymns. It's a very Americana, folky kind of thing, and it's great for really all generations, little kids, and we have banjos and fiddles and mandolins and ukuleles and lots of three-part harmony. And hymns have a kind of a magical way of kind of bridging a lot of gaps. And so it's been really fun to do that with Andrew.
For resources, books, and Bible studies mentioned in the show, visit edstetzer.com. And while you're there, check out past episodes or read the latest study and analysis from Lifeway Research. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange. We hope you'll be back with us again next week.